Morning in the matter of State versus Ashley Bailey. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Elizabeth C. Jarrett, Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Ms. Bailey.
Good morning, Your Honor. Shira Wasatsky, on behalf of Amicus, American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jamie Bialik from the law firm of Pashman Stein Walder Hayden, as Amicus on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Prosecutor Kevin Hine on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Deputy Attorney General William P. Cooper Dobb for the Attorney General's amicus curiae.
Welcome to all counsel, and I invite you to incorporate any arguments that have been made before your turn at the podium. The virtual podium comes up. Please do so as appropriate. Ms. Jarrett, please go ahead.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
May please the court. At its core, the ex post facto clause is grounded in principles of fundamental fairness and the concept that people should be able to rely on their rights and privileges without fear they will be taken from them retroactively by the government in order to secure a criminal conviction. The founders described laws violating these principles as formidable instruments of tyranny and prohibited them under the Constitution as a bulwark in favor of personal security. One of society's most cherished and fundamental rights, rooted in personal security and autonomy, is the right to marriage. Another is the privilege against self-incrimination. To effectuate both of these rights, society has long recognized the marital privilege, which seeks to preserve and fortify the strength of the marital union and keep private those conversations shared only between spouses. Allowing the state to take away this privilege retroactively after a person has reasonably relied on it in order to use previously protected communications to deprive that person of their liberty is the very kind of governmental abuse prohibited by the ex post facto clause. Yet that is precisely what occurred here. After learning that she had become the target of an internal affairs investigation, Ms. Bailey confided in her husband, expressing her fears and seeking solace in the one person she knew she could speak freely to. She and her husband exchanged loving and supportive messages in which she expressed disappointment in herself and her decision to choose the love she had for her husband over all else to her own detriment. Though these messages were privileged at the time they were made, the trial court retroactively applied an exception to the marital communications privilege to strip the messages of their protections. This did not simply apply a rule of procedure in effect at the time of trial. Instead, application of the new law retroactively stripped Ms. Bailey of a substantive protection in order to convict her of a criminal offense. Doing so violates the ex post facto clause. Today, I plan to focus on three main points. The first is that the marital communications privilege is no ordinary rule of procedure, but is instead a substantive protection that effectuates several fundamental rights. The second is that changes to the privilege are ex post facto laws under Calder's fourth category, as interpreted by both this court and the United States Supreme Court. And third is that even if it was proper to apply the change to the law in this case, Ms. Bailey's communications with her husband do not fall within the exception to the privilege. Turning to the marital communications privilege, this privilege dates back more than 400 years ago and is grounded in both the privilege against self-incrimination and the fundamental right of marriage. The purpose of the privilege is to foster uninhibited communications, and the privilege has been described by the United States Supreme Court as, quote, essential to preservation of the marital relationship. And this marital relationship, most recently by the United States Supreme Court, has been declared a fundamental right. The privilege also creates a zone of privacy. This marital zone of privacy is also recognized as a constitutional right by the United States Supreme Court in Griswold. And finally, the privilege is grounded in the idea that spouses are one unit and are thus entitled to be free from government intrusion into communications of that unit, which is effectuates the privilege against self-incrimination. The privileges, even though they are codified in our rules of evidence, are distinct from the other rules of evidence, which are more rules of procedure. Rules of procedure, their purpose is concerns the reliability and the relevance of evidence admitted in the courtroom. Privileges, on the other hand, deal with channeling behavior outside of the courtroom and effectuating the fundamental rights that I've already discussed. In addition, the other rules of procedure and the rules of evidence apply in the courtroom, as I just said. However, privileges apply in many other circumstances outside of the courtroom, or even when the rules of evidence don't apply. So for example, at suppression hearings, although the rules of evidence don't apply, hearsay is allowed, for example, the privileges do, the privileges still hold there. They also apply in the area of pretrial discovery. In addition, they apply concerning the other branches of government, not just the judiciary. The history of the rules of evidence indicate that the privileges were included only as a matter of convenience and not because they were regarded as similar in kind to the other rules of procedure. And I think it's noteworthy that the first privilege in our rules of evidence in the same section as the marital privilege is the privilege against self-incrimination, which I think we would all agree is not an ordinary rule of procedure. Another source of looking to how important or how substantive privileges are is the Erie Doctrine. In federal court, when courts are sitting in diversity, courts apply the substantive rules of the state and the rules of procedure of the federal courts. And the federal courts have held that privileges are considered substantive rules. And so they apply the state substantive rules. Finally, in Lewis v. Harris, this court's gay marriage case, and in Obergefell, the United States gay marriage case, both of these cases cited to the marital privilege as one of the benefits of marriage, the denial of which violated the constitutions. So in sum, the marital communications privilege is a substantive protection rooted in several fundamental rights.
Ms. Jarrett, you begin your presentation by saying it was reasonable to rely on the privilege at the time the critical communication, I think it was in September of 2014, took place in this case. Facts are a little unusual here in that that happened 2 months after the Supreme Court issued an opinion that called for a change in the privilege itself, that proposed a crime fraud exception to the privilege, that asked the legislature and the governor to act on it. How reasonable was it for someone to rely on that aspect of the privilege in light of what had just taken place?
Mm-hmm. So I think, first of all, as I've said, the privilege dates back for more than 400 years. So up until
I want to start in July of 2014, if that's all right with you.
Of course. So in July of 2014, you know, Terry had just recently been decided, and this court said we should adopt this privilege, but it hadn't yet been adopted. So I think it was reasonable for anyone reading that case law to realize that this court on its own felt like it could not act alone. And until the other branches of government acted, it could not enact that privilege.
May I ask if a client had come in to a reasonable colleague's office in your office and said, is it safe for me to rely on the privilege in September of 2014? Would a reasonable attorney looking at what had just happened said, sure, you're protected, don't worry about it?
I think it depends on how risk averse the attorney is. A very risk averse attorney would say it's an open question. We don't have case law on this quite yet. I think the court will rule you will be fine. However, let's be super safe about it, right? And not. I think that's maybe how I would advise my client.
I want to talk about that hypothetical reasonable attorney.
Mm-hmm.
How would a reasonable attorney have responded to the question in your judgment?
I think a reasonable attorney would say, it seems like the court thinks that there should be an exception to this rule. And it has directed the legislature to act and the governor to sign a rule. And it seems like in the future, once this exception comes into being, then communications are not going to be privileged anymore.
So you're talking about reasonable reliance in the moment, and that's why I'm asking you what reasonable guidance in that interim period would be. And I'm not quite sure we got to the end. Does the reasonable attorney in your judgment say, you go ahead and have that conversation, you've got nothing to worry about, you will be protected? I say that based on my reasonable analysis of what's going on today.
I would say Well, first of all, I think a reasonable attorney would always say, you know, don't have any communications or write anything down about crimes or frauds that you may be committing. I think that's the first thing a reasonable attorney would say. But that I do really think that in Terry, I mean, Terry didn't apply the crime fraud exception to Terry, Mr. Terry, because it couldn't. And so the fact that it couldn't do that, I think a reasonable attorney reading that opinion would say, until the legislature acts, it's not an exception right. In this state.
Does it make a difference? Because until the legislature acts, it's not a law. We wrote State versus Byrd and recommended the forfeiture by wrongdoing. We sent it to the legislature and the legislature didn't do anything.
That's right.
Didn't do anything at all.
Yeah.
And then we had to go, because there were two routes by which you can enact a rule of evidence. So an entire like year went by and then we had to take another route. So there is this agreement between the legislature and the Supreme Court, unless both act in some sort of form of unison, no evidence rule goes into effect. Am I correct?
I agree completely. And I think that this court determining that it couldn't act alone and it needed the legislature to act, until that happened, it couldn't, you know, become a law. This is a law that required passage by the legislature and a signature by the governor. And for example, for the forfeiture by wrongdoing statute, it could have been the same path there. And if there was an indication that the legislature didn't want this to pass, then it would have potentially never become law, or there would have had to be a judicial conference.
I have another question for you. Do you doubt that the legislature could actually remove the spousal privilege? That they could abolish it?
If
they abolished it, your position would be they can't retroactively employ it.
That's correct. That's entirely correct. The privileges are a creation of, first common law, then they were codified. So the legislature, as long as it doesn't violate a fundamental right, I guess that would be another case. But in terms of ex post facto, it wouldn't be an ex post facto violation if they abolished it for future cases or conduct. I wanna get into the ex post facto clause a little bit and talk about how the definition of the fourth Calder category that we are talking about today. The fourth Calder category states that every law that alters the legal rules of evidence and receives less or different testimony than the law required at the time of the commission of the offense in order to convict the offender is a violation of the ex post facto clause. And so that law, that category, which says every law that alters the legal rule of evidence must have some kind of legal limiting principle to it. Otherwise, any rule of procedure would violate that Calder category. As both this court and the United States Supreme Court have held, that this fourth Calder category deals with substantive changes to the rule, and it relates to fundamental fairness interests and the government, the idea that the government cannot refuse after the fact to play by its own rules and change them in order to secure a criminal conviction. And so I want to talk about that my adversary relies on quite a bit in its brief. And in Collins, the court specifically overturned two prior cases that the Supreme Court had found that there was an ex post facto violation, but they did so based on laws that did not fall into one of the four Calder categories, because it wasn't any of the first three and it was not a rule of evidence. One had to do with changing the number of jurors, one had to do with the significance, I'm sorry, a plea. As to whether or not it's an acquittal or not. And in Collins, the court held that there's no extra fifth category just based on notions of fundamental fairness. It has to fall within one of those four. It also cited to a case, Beazle is a 1925 case, saying that Beazle is the correct interpretation of the Calder categories. And in Beazle, our court stated, or the Supreme Court stated, that the distinction between whether or not a law violates that fourth category cannot be embraced with a formula or stated in a general proposition. The distinction is one of degree. And the Constitution was intended to secure substantial personal rights against arbitrary and oppressive legislation, and not to limit the legislative control of remedies and modes of procedure which do not affect matters of substance. And so Collins itself still adhered to the limiting principle that I talked about earlier in terms of whether or not a law violated the fourth Calder category, looking at how substantive it is and how substantial it was. This court in State v. Moore, dating back to the 1800s, also used similar language about substantial protections in terms of whether or not the law would violate that fourth Calder category. And this court in State v. Muhammad more recently, also citing Collins, stated that there was no ex post facto violation because the law did not alter any substantive rights of the defendant. So,
Ms. Jarrett, what about the line in Carmel, which stated that, referring to rules that either allow the admission of evidence or don't, and don't alter the threshold for what constitutes a legal sufficiency in terms of the state, meaning its burden of proof. Such rules, by simply permitting evidence to be admitted at trial, do not at all subvert the presumption of innocence because they do not concern whether the admissible evidence is sufficient to overcome the presumption. Presumably, that rule encompasses a myriad of evidentiary changes. Obviously, just to use our what this court does periodically is make significant and some significance, perhaps some more ministerial changes to the rules of evidence every few years. So why is this case not in that latter category that the Supreme Court cited?
Yes. So in Carmel, the court did find an ex post facto violation because the rule did change the quantum of evidence necessary to support a conviction. And that was exactly the same thing that or it was exactly like Lord Fenwick's case, which it went into quite in detail, and was one of the reasons that the ex post facto clause was adopted. However, that is just one example of how an ex post facto law could violate the Constitution.
I would be with you, Ms. Jarrett, on that point if the court did not make the distinction that it made in that case. And what I'm if that is the distinction that holds. Why are we not here? I mean, as I understand this case, this is not, there's nothing in the crime fraud exceptions to the marital privilege that alters the burden of proof on the state. State maintains its burden of proof, all the elements of the offense by beyond a reasonable doubt. But we have here a change to an evidentiary rule that for mm-hmm. some, if you want to Venn diagram it, for some categories of evidence makes evidence admissible where it would not be before. So why is that not within that second category that was cited by the Supreme Court?
So Carmel still stuck to the Calder categories. It cited to Calder. It said Calder is the right way to interpret this. Justice Chase was correct. His interpretation of the ex post facto clause is what we should adhere to. And so when you look to Calder v. Bull and to Justice Chase's description of these categories, I think that's really instructive because Calder explained that one way to violate the ex post facto clause, and this is a quote from Calder, which was also in a footnote in Carmel, one way to violate the ex post facto clause is admitting one witness when the existing law required to, right? That's changing the quantum of evidence exactly as you noted. The next line, Calder says, another was, quote, receiving evidence without oath, or the oath of the wife against the husband, or other testimony which the courts of justice would not admit. So that's another way that Justice Chase stated in Calder approved of by in Carmel, that it could violate the ex post facto clause. So it's more than simply just changing the quantum of evidence necessary.
That was at a time when the marital privilege was obviously very, very strictly adhered to by the US Supreme Court for lots of reasons that sound a little anachronistic, you know, today to us perhaps. But it's still, you still have a later case here from a couple decades ago where the court seems to be drawing a distinction between rules that alter the threshold of evidence, the quantum of evidence required, and evidentiary rules. You know, obviously the feds do the same as perhaps we do here, you know, changing evidentiary rules in small or large ways periodically. And it seems what the court was trying to do was to say that not every one of those changes is going to trigger an ex post facto issue. So I get that, but for Carmel, if Calder were the last word, that description is helpful to you. But I think the Supreme Court has spoken again in a clarifying way. And I'm just trying to see if, do you have an argument if Carmel's description, if Carmel's distinction is the operative distinction, do you have an argument as to why this would be a violation of ex post facto?
Yeah, so there were two cases after Carmel that I would like to draw your attention to. Two more recent Supreme Court cases. One is Stogner v. California. That was in 2003. And the other is Pew v. United States. And I want to talk about those a little bit. So in Stogner v. California, the court held that a change to the statute of limitations after it had run is an ex post facto violation. And it found so under Calder's second category. But it also held that it could also be a violation of Calder's fourth category. And that doesn't have to do with like quantum of evidence. It has to do with fundamental fairness in issues. It has to do with reliance issues. And when in this opinion, the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, post Carmel, post Collins, explained with approval our court's decision in State v. Moore, the very old case from the 1800s, cited with approval to that case and our court's discussion about the fundamental fairness concerns, about the substantive protections concerns of the fourth Calder category. And it cited that as with approval as a way to interpret that part of the fourth Calder category in the ex post facto clause. And then again, later in Pew, the court again, in that case, held that administrative changes to the federal sentencing guidelines were an ex post facto clause, and it violated the Calder categories. And in that case, again, the Supreme Court stated, our holding today is consistent with basic principles of fairness that animate the ex post facto clause.
The framers I think for reasons that we probably should avoid, or at least I will avoid from the interest of time talking about, those two cases have really raised different issues. Is Carmel the last word, as far as you know, on the evidentiary aspect of the fourth category?
I don't think so, because I think Stogner also talks about the fourth category, the evidentiary category.
But Stogner is talking about the ability to charge someone with an offense at all regarding the statute of limitations, which I think you could probably agree is much different than the issue we have here regarding the admissibility of evidence. Wouldn't you agree? Yes. I mean, that's a very significant difference between what we're talking about here and a statute of limitations issue that would prevent the charging from in the first instance. So to piggyback off of Justice Patterson's comments, I think those two cases are significantly different. And it does seem like that language in Carmel is probably the last word thus far with regard to evidentiary changes in the evidence rules.
So when you look at Carmel, I think Carmel itself does not do away with the substantive procedural distinction of the fourth category. So in footnote 23, Carmel states, We do not mean to say that every rule that has an effect on whether a defendant may be convicted implicates the ex post facto clause, which we all agree on here. It says ordinary rules of evidence, for example, do not violate the clause. And it goes on to talk about what an ordinary rule of evidence means. It says, to the extent one may consider changes, you know, unfair or unjust, those don't implicate the kind of unfairness implicated by changing the quantum of evidence or those affecting. And then it cites Justice Calder's categories and taxonomy as an example of, quote, admitting the oath of the wife against the husband, which Carmel in 2000, not just in Calder, but in Carmel in 2000 recognizes would violate the ex post facto clause.
Ms. Chow, are we just in a different species in rules of, this is different from a rule of evidence. This is the way you started out. Privileges are substantive rights. We've recognized that they're substantive rights. So it's not a question of whether or not this evidence can come in here or this evidence can come in there. These are privacy rights, autonomy rights, rights of intimacy. You mentioned Lewis versus Harris. We ticked off, this court ticked off 10 rights that were not afforded to committed same-sex couples that were given to married couples. And one of those rights was the testimonial privilege given to the spouse of an accused in a criminal action. So this isn't the hearsay rule. This isn't whether this comes in. This is whether or not you can retroactively alter a substantive right. And if you can alter it, actually eliminate it retroactively. Go ahead.
Yes, I completely agree with how Your Honor is framing the case. I do want to distinguish Rose a bit, which did hold that a change to the hearsay rule could be retroactively applied. You know, hearsay is a quintessential rule of procedure. And so that it doesn't affect a substantive right that this court has recognized or all pretty much every court has recognized in terms of what privileges mean to people. One thing I think is really interesting, interesting difference between the forfeiture by wrongdoing exception and the exception here is that both were done through the rules of evidence. However, as Justice Albin already talked about, the forfeiture by wrongdoing was enacted as part of a judicial conference and then in action by the legislature and the governor. So it was, you know, it relied on the inaction of those two other branches, but it was really done by the only affirmative action by this branch. The exception that we're talking about today, this court had proposed a rule. Then there was legislative action in the form of a statute, a joint resolution, and then the governor signed it. And so that need to enact an exception through all three branches of government does signify a much more substantive change to our rights and privileges than a change to a hearsay rule, for example.
Ms. Jarrett, we're about at the end of your time. Is there anything you wanted to raise with us you haven't yet touched on and to do so concisely?
Yes, I'll be very quick. Even if there was no ex post facto violation, the court should then conduct a simple statutory interpretation question to determine whether or not the legislature preferred that this rule should be applied retroactively or intended it should be applied retroactively or prospectively. The effective date of the statute indicates it should be applied prospective only, but even more so, the statute was signed into law in November. That did change the statute part of this, but then this court, about a couple weeks later, changed the rules so that it would be in the rule book correctly in December. And in the notes for that change, this court stated that it would be retroactive only to the time that it changed in November. So this court has also already spoken on how it felt, what date it should be retroactive to already.
The notes that you're referring to are which precisely?
So if you look on the judiciary's website, the rules of evidence listed there following it, there's a comment and it states when the rule change would be retroactive to. So not the statutory change, but the rule change. I could provide those to you if you'd like as well.
Please go ahead.
Even if this is to be applied retroactively, the communications here did not fall under the crime fraud exception to the rule. So as this court stated in Terry, the crime fraud exception should not allow confessions of a spouse to another spouse to be admitted at trial. It should only allow communications that jointly advance a crime or fraud. And here, these communications did none of those things. There was nothing advancing the drug conspiracy. It could not be a future or ongoing crime related to any of the alleged disclosures from the police reports, which had occurred, months before. There was no confidential information disclosed within these text messages themselves. And it could not relate to the briefing that would occur months later, because Ms. Bailey had no idea that was going to happen. It's not enough that both spouses might be involved in criminal behavior. There's public policy interests that promote even confessions between criminal spouses. I also want to emphasize that the state here was the proponent of the evidence in this case. They had the burden to demonstrate that it fell within the exception, and they did not do so. Just touching on the harmless error analysis in this case, these text messages were at the heart of the state's case. There was pretty much no direct evidence in the record concerning the mens rea element of the crime she was convicted of, if Ms. Bailey had a purpose to benefit herself or others. And that was really the question that the jury needed to determine. And the state relied heavily on these text messages for that specific purpose. I want to emphasize that when admitting them into trial, the state had actors read them. So they didn't, that surely had an impact on the jury. It was also the last piece of evidence that they admitted into trial right before they just did some stipulations and then rested. The state relied on this theme in opening that Ms. Bailey chose love over her oath, which was taken from the text messages themselves. And then in closing, they played the text messages, they echoed this theme, they stated that these text messages are what proves her intent, and they state that these text messages contradict her own testimony where she said she did not have this intent. So for those reasons, unless your honors have any questions, For those reasons, the marital communications privilege is a substantive rule that protects fundamental rights, and a retroactive change in order to convict Ms. Bailey of a crime violates the ex post facto clause, and this court should reverse the appellate division decision.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Ms. Wysotsky.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The ACLU of New Jersey urges the court to find a presumption that the ex post facto clauses of both the federal and the state constitutions are triggered when two conditions, both of which are present in this case, are both met. The first is when a modification of an evidentiary rule is so significant that it must be adopted in a manner that's consistent with the Evidence Act, and also second, when the proposed modification without notice and without fair warning to the individual will plausibly impact the speech or behavior of an individual immediately preceding, during, or following a charged offense, which renders that modification substantive and similarly significant. My very able colleagues have outlined many arguments about the history of the statute and the evidentiary rule and the constitutional issues in this case. And so for the purpose of analyzing the substantive nature of the changes at issue, the ACLU of New Jersey would like to briefly emphasize the choices that were made by the New Jersey legislature to codify privileges and to statutorily protect communication within certain relationships. Unlike the federal government, which leaves the governance of privilege claims to common law, New Jersey has made a conscious choice to specifically craft and to legislate privilege and to legislate those exceptions. As a legal system, we assume that people follow the law and we assume that people rely on the law when they're making decisions. It was reasonable for this defendant, a police officer, or really for any person, to have relied on the protections that were provided in the law when deciding whether to engage in speech that could later be used as incriminating evidence. This is particularly true because at the time that the defendant sent the text messages, there were explicit and codified crime fraud exceptions to at least five other privileges in the New Jersey Rules of Evidence. It would have been exceedingly reasonable for this defendant to believe that the legislature had explicitly opted out of adopting a crime fraud exception to the marital communications privilege, because at the time that she sent the text messages, the New Jersey legislature had. If I might for a moment address, Chief Justice, your question to Ms. Jarrett about the reasonable attorney hypothetical and what a lawyer would have counseled their client, just to expand on Ms. Jarrett's answer, I want to highlight the language that this court used in State v. Brown explaining the purposes of the ex post facto clauses. And quoting Weaver v. Graham, this court wrote that it seeks not to guarantee an individual's right to less punishment, but to guard against a lack of fair notice. That notice runs to the individual. And to echo Justice Albin's comment, without the enactment of the law, that notice wasn't provided yet to the defendant in this case. And so although this case doesn't fall squarely within the ambit of the Fifth Amendment and the state law rights against self-incrimination, there are similar principles at play, which renders this change significant and substantive and also differentiates it from the other ex post facto cases that have come before this court and the New Jersey judiciary that have involved rules of evidence, but not necessarily the substantive change that changes when a person's own words that were spoken in the context of a historically and a legislatively privileged relationship could be used against them to secure a criminal conviction. So unless there are any questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Bialik.
Thank you. Good morning, your honors. May it please the court. I don't want to belabor some of the arguments that have been made, and I'll rely mostly on the briefs, but I would like to highlight a couple of points that have been made but are really crucial to this court's holding. And the first one is that privileges are no ordinary rules of evidence, and it really was error for the lower courts to treat them as such and merely just slap a procedural label on them. You know, rules of evidence are designed to help ensure the accuracy and reliability and trustworthiness of the information that's coming out at trial. And the purpose of privileges is exactly the opposite. Evidentiary privileges, by their design, conceal facts in order to protect certain interests and relationships that a public policy decision has been made are worthy of those protections. And the important thing is it extends beyond the marital privilege and has implications for all of the other privileges that are codified, the attorney-client privilege, the doctor-patient privilege, priest-penitent privilege, and all of the other privileges where the relationships and the communications are important, almost sacred, and the policy is to encourage open and truthful communications and to encourage the relationship itself. And a retroactive application or elimination of such a privilege without notice, what would that do to any of the privileges? You know, privileges and other evidence rules, they may sort of live together in a sequential order in law books, but I believe it was Justice Albin that said it, they're different species. They have different origins, they function differently. And for that reason, you can't just say it's a mere rule of procedure and it governs the trial and should be treated as such, which is what the courts have done here. A good example is the attorney-client privilege. And that's the one that we sort of encounter in day-to-day practice. And, you know, we need to think about how that would be impacted by a decision here. Because the statements such as the ones that Ms. Bailey made to her husband, those are something you can foresee a client coming into your office as an attorney and stating to you. They're bemoaning their actions. They are expressing guilt and regret for things that have happened and seeking advice and counsel to how to get out of it. Those statements are almost something that attorneys would hear on a routine day-to-day basis. And to say that they were privileged one day and not privileged the next, what would that do to the attorney-client relationship? It would inhibit truthful communications and the function of the attorney to assist their client. So it's important that this court not lose sight of, you know, we're talking about more than just the marital privilege. A decision is privileges are or are not substantive. And to find that they're not substantive would be to eradicate a lot of the protections that the privileges afford. And just real quick, in terms of the substance, the ACDL believes that the actual exception, the crime fraud exception, should receive a narrower interpretation than the ones that this court's applied here. It's not that any language relating to a crime or fraud would come within the exception. As I mentioned, a lot of times clients come into their attorney's office stating very similar things to what Ms. Bailey said to her husband. And those would not come within the crime fraud exception because as that exception has been applied, at least to the attorney-client privilege, it pertains to ongoing or future crimes. It doesn't encompass completed crimes. And so to hold that that communication comes within the crime fraud exception is to essentially hold that the attorney-client privilege is more sacred than the spousal privilege, because under similar circumstances, those communications would likely be privileged in a lawyer-client scenario. So we believe that the court should make an instruction as to how that privilege should be interpreted. It's not simply that the communications must relate to an ongoing crime or fraud, but it's that it must advance or perpetuate that crime or fraud. And similar to the language that this court used in Terry, which is that there's collusion between spouses to advance a joint criminal enterprise. So that is the definition of the crime fraud exception, and a similar one should apply to the marital privilege as it does to the attorney-client privilege. So unless there's any questions, I will rely on my briefs and everyone else's arguments.
Thank you, Ms. Bialik. Mr. Hein.
Thank you, Your Honors. In this case, the court's tasked with deciding whether the unreasonable protection of communications between spouses related to their joint crimes should continue to immunize spouses' criminal activity, or whether such communications should be rooted out as unworthy of protection, as this court decided in Terry, no matter when the words were uttered. They most certainly should be, and as they were in this case, and there's no reason why they can't. One thing I found notable as I've listened to counsel's arguments this morning is that there's been no discussion whatsoever on the particular reasons behind the crime fraud exception to begin with. We're not asking, the state's not here, and I don't think anyone would ever ask to abolish the marital privilege. But what happened in Terry is this court decided to abolish an aspect of it that was never intended. It was never intended that spouses should be able to communicate with each other about their ongoing crimes, and that those communications should remain immunized. We're talking about privileges which have always been construed narrowly and which only exist to the extent that they serve society's interests. To rule otherwise would essentially turn the privileges on their head, and society's interest would be subservient to whatever privileges existed at the time a crime or an act occurred. I want to begin, and I don't really have an opening, so I'd invite questions at any point. But I'd like to begin by addressing the Carmel factor that was discussed a little bit earlier, and echo some of the questions that Justice Patterson and Justice Pierre-Louis mentioned. There's no question that the fourth factor in those list of factors as discussed in Carmel does not apply in this case. Those factors were clearly, or that factor clearly talks simply about new rules that authorize a conviction on less evidence than previously required. Carmel, of course, discussed a new rule of evidence that enabled the state to convict a sex offender with less evidence than it needed at the time when the crime occurred. And the Carmel court very reasonably decided that that new statute's practical effect was to lower the quantum of evidence or of proof necessary to convict. Here we have a privilege, an unreasonable interpretation of a privilege that no longer applied.
Mr. Hine, can I?
Yes, Your Honor.
I asked this question of Ms. Jarrett, and I'd like to ask it of you. Could this court and the legislature abolish the marital privilege and apply its abolition retroactively?
You know, I obviously have been thinking about that question since you asked, and I'm not entirely sure. That's obviously not what happened here, but I would venture to say that no, but this case is distinguishable here.
Well,
I'd like to explain why.
Well, first tell me why no. Why couldn't we do it? Is it because it's I'm trying to define what this privilege is. And if your answer to that question is no, you couldn't do it, is it because you're recognizing that the spousal privilege is a substantive right and therefore it could not be abolished retroactively? Is that the reason why you're answering no?
I'm sorry. I must have misunderstood the question. No, my answer is yes.
Oh, you could. Okay, so your position is the legislature and this court could abolish the spousal privilege and apply it retroactively. So in this particular case, assuming that there was no crime fraud exception and they engaged in a regular marital communication, it's your position that the abolition could work retroactively and the communications could be introduced into evidence, correct?
Well, my position is I take a bit, I disagree with the word retroactive, I guess, in your hypothetical, because I don't think there's anything retroactive taking place here.
Well,
this is a prospective application of a new rule of evidence
Let me be clear about my question. There's a spousal communication, let's say in 2015. And in 2020, the legislature in the court says there is no spousal privilege. And the trial is in 2021. Your position is, despite the fact that the communication was in 2015, the law was changed in 2020, the spousal communication can be introduced to trial, correct or not correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, because I believe I understood the question initially. The semantics, I think, is important in this case, because the defense, and in your question, Your Honor, you talk about a retroactive application, and we simply don't believe nothing is happening retroactively here. This is a prospective application of an ordinary rule of evidence because it merely alters the scope of admissible evidence at trial.
Isn't an ordinary rule of evidence? Carmel in footnote 23 speaks about even-handed rules of evidence. This one only seems to apply to one side. Only the prosecution can benefit from it. Is that not correct?
Well, you're correct, Your Honor. It did talk about even-handedness. So it also mentioned that even-handedness, my interpretation of the language of that case is that even-handedness is one of a few and maybe even the least important of those factors. But I would argue that it can apply even-handedly. Obviously, in our case, it didn't. However, there are circumstances I could imagine where a co-defendant wanted to introduce testimony of crime fraud communications between another co-defendant and his co-defendant's spouse, and would seek to benefit from that, not to the benefit of the state, of course, but to the benefit of himself.
Might not be easy for them to actually get that evidence. That's the practical distinction
That's correct, Your Honor, but assuming that evidence was discovered and passed along a discovery, it actually could have very easily happened in a case like this, where there were wiretaps and there was evidence and text messages from all different parties. It very easily could have happened that one of these other co-defendants, of which there were numerous, could have found something in those text messages between those spouses that would have benefited him and used them. And so in that way, I do believe it's even-handed. While yes, it may benefit the state more often than not, I don't think that means it's not even-handed or could apply in either direction.
Tell us, if this case, the proofs that the state had rested entirely on text messages that predated the actual adoption of the revised rule, would your position be the same? Could you convict, if the only evidence that you had, could you convict anyone, if the only evidence you had came from communications made at a time that the rule protected them?
So I, just to make sure I'm understanding Your Honor's question correctly, are you getting at that fourth Carmel factor on whether or not if that's the only evidence and therefore it would violate that fourth factor?
No, I'm asking a broader question. Okay. Assume that this case rested entirely on this and perhaps other text messages that were not protected, that were protected at the time the communications were made. Could you prevail?
Yes, I believe we would, for the very same reasons that we should prevail as it is. I don't see how that would alter the analysis in any way. Regardless, those text messages should come in because, as we're arguing, that it is an ordinary rule of evidence that changed, and therefore the crime fraud exception should apply. I think it's important to note too that talking about unfairness, you know, our adversaries talk a lot about unfairness, and the Carmel court our courts in Rose, and then citing Carmel, specifically noted that yes, there is some unfairness that takes place when there's a change in rule of evidence. To the extent one may consider changes to the rules unfair or unjust, they do not implicate the same kind of unfairness as those setting forth a sufficiency of the evidence standard. And that's because the state, this change in law had no impact on whether the state could meet its burden. The bar, if conviction is a bar, the bar was not lowered as a result of this change of evidence rule. Had it been lowered, like it was in Carmel, well then yes, of course, there would be an ex post facto problem there.
I take it, Mr. Hine, that you do not consider the marital privilege to be a substantive right, correct? Or am I mistaken about that?
That's good. And so far as it's a privilege that's narrowly construed and only exists to the extent that it serves society's interest, absolutely not.
Do you consider any of the privileges substantive rights?
I think there are some privileges that certainly have constitutional underpinnings, such as the attorney-client privilege. Certainly that has underpinnings in the right against self-incrimination.
Mr. Hine, I'm sorry, I was not following your response to Justice Alvin's question. Do you or don't you consider the marital privilege to be a substantive right? Because there were a couple negatives being used there, and I just want to make sure I understand.
Yes, Justice Patterson, I apologize. I do not consider it to be a substantive right. I consider it to be a rule of evidence that this court or the legislature can change, and that trials are to enforce at the time of trial, whenever that trial occurs. Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose there's a different view. Accept Justice Albin's suggestion in his question that the marital privilege is a substantive right. Is this aspect of the privilege a substantive right? And can it be looked at in that fashion?
I believe it could be. So if this court were to find that that privileges are substantive rights, or that the marital privilege in particular is a substantive right, this particular narrow exception, the crime fraud exception, didn't remove any substantive right. To the extent a substantive right exists within the privilege, it has remained and nothing substantive was taken away. I believe this court in Terry and then the legislature itself clearly said that this new rule served to remove an unintended consequence of the marital privilege and preserved every single purpose behind it. Every single purpose that the marital privilege is designed to protect has been retained despite this new rule. And so I don't think you can say that a substantive right has been removed. Yes, perhaps, I'm not conceding, but perhaps on another day, on another case, if this court or the legislature, which I can't imagine ever would, removed the marital privilege, perhaps there would be a substantive right there, not conceding. But to the extent that the crime fraud exception removed any aspect of the privilege, that aspect certainly was not substantive.
Well, it opens up the privilege because ultimately there's debate among the attorneys here about whether or not this actually falls within the crime fraud exception, whether it's ongoing. So that means it goes to the jury, whether it fits within it or it doesn't fit within it. And that opens up the entire spousal privilege. Do you agree?
I disagree, Your Honor. Of course, trial judges act as gatekeepers. They're not just going to allow the state or any other party to willy-nilly admit evidence and claim it's crime fraud.
Not willy-nilly, but if it's subject to two reasonable interpretations, it is or it isn't, then it's going to go to the jury, correct?
Correct. I think if a trial judge finds that there's a reasonable interpretation that it falls under the crime fraud exception, then it goes to the jury. I don't think that creates some kind of slippery slope where privileges are subject to substantive, due process violations or anything like that. I think this is a very narrow exception that was drawn that this court and the legislature emphasized was never the intended purpose. And there's nothing substantive that was taken away. Again, the legislature made that very clear. And I think this court made that very clear in Terry that this merely served to remove an unintended consequence of the privilege. You can't removing something that was never intended in a sub, even if it's a substantive right, doesn't remove anything substantive.
Mr. Hine, what is your response to Ms. Jarrett's reference to the notes to Rule 509 that indicate that the amendment to the rule is to be retroactive to November 2015 when the legislature passed the statute? What is your response to her reference to that and how that plays into the fairness and the expectation of individuals with regard to the court rules and what will or will not be admitted?
Excuse me. I don't necessarily think that should play too much or have too much weight in the analysis. Again, since this is a right, the privileges in and of themselves are construed narrowly, and again, only apply to the extent that they serve the public interest. When this court found that this didn't serve the public interest, and when the legislature found that it didn't serve the public interest, then the privilege didn't apply.
So the Chief Justice asked what a reasonable lawyer would do under these circumstances. If a lawyer checks in the judiciary website under the rules of evidence and sees from the judiciary website a statement of when the rule takes effect, you think it's reasonable for a reasonable lawyer to rely on that?
Well, absolutely. I don't think so. I mean, perhaps I misunderstood the question.
I'm a lawyer. I'm looking at the rules of evidence. I go to the judiciary website, and then the rule in the website it says it's effective November 2015. I don't have a right to rely on that.
Well, you could, I believe a reasonable lawyer could rely on an effective date, but I don't think a reasonable lawyer would do so without looking into it further, without looking at the reasons behind the rule, without looking behind. And also I should note that a reasonable lawyer will look at a rule of evidence effective date and think, oh, okay, any trial after that effective date is going to apply that new rule, which is exactly what happened here.
So if you were in the situation of a reasonable lawyer before that date, but there is a situation happening that could result in a trial after that date, if you saw that happen to see what that would be, would you be advising a client not to make those communications because trial may occur after the effective date?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because my interpretation would be that a change to the rule of evidence, that's merely an ordinary rule of evidence that doesn't change the quantum of evidence required to prove guilt, is going to apply at the time of trial, which is exactly what happened here. And so that would be my recommendation to that client.
So if there is ambiguity about whether it's retroactive for purposes of when the communication occurred or for the purposes of when the trial begins, assuming that there is ambiguity about that, then we have this doctrine of manifest injustice in terms of the way we interpret legislation. And we are counseled to construe the legislation in a way that is not going to abrogate previously existing rights. That's if we were to go to that interpretive canon. And why wouldn't we then? If we couldn't tell whether or not the legislature wanted it retroactive to the date of the communication or for the purpose of the trial. Go ahead.
You know, I haven't thought about that simply because I don't think there's anything ambiguous. Perhaps if there was an ambiguous thing, then yes, that would require a whole nother analysis. You know, I'm not really prepared today to do that. What I'm prepared today to argue is that there is no ambiguity when the legislature clearly indicates that all of the purposes behind the privilege have remained, and all of the unintended consequences of the privilege without this exception have been removed. I don't see any ambiguity in that whatsoever.
Are you aware of any other cases where there's been a focus on that type of language in a rule of evidence comment when there's been a rule of evidence change?
I'm not, Your Honor. Looking at cases around the country, there certainly have been other changes to the marital privilege that have been found to be to apply at the time of trial, despite when the crime occurred. For example, in Michigan, that court, that state amended to allow disclosure to the discretion of a single spouse. And that court ruled that didn't modify the evidence necessary to obtain a conviction. So it found that there was no ex post facto violation. And one might say, oh, this is different. You know, that's simply to allow disclosure at the discretion of either party. I would argue that change is extremely significant. It cuts. I think this court has ruled in cases that change, when this court made that change, or when this state made that change, that severely weakened the privilege. Severely weakened the privilege because it removed a great degree of expectation of privacy if one spouse could at any point decide to disclose what the other spouse said. And so I would argue that while it's not the same change as the crime fraud exception, that the Michigan court got it right. The Michigan court got it right when they found that rule didn't modify the evidence necessary to obtain a conviction. So it didn't fall under that fourth Carmel category, and therefore there was no ex post facto violation.
I'm struggling a bit to understand the import of the rule, and I'd like you to tell us of the comment after the rule, and I'd like you to help us. It is a statement about an effective date that was made after the legislation was passed, after the conduct in this case took place. Does the court typically rule on retroactivity in that fashion?
Your Honor.
You take it as a substantive analysis of retroactivity from the court's comment in,
I don't have the rule book in front of me at the moment, on whatever date that comment was inserted?
No, Your Honor, I don't. To the extent, perhaps I'm just, you know, being a bit circuitous, but to the extent that it does, it doesn't defeat our argument, because this trial took place well after that. I guess to the extent that we're talking about a substantive change, again, our argument is that there was no substantive change to the rule, that every degree of substance in the privilege still exists today. The only thing removed was something that was never intended to be there anyway. So you didn't remove any substance. Therefore, any degree of relying on that at the time it was made was not a substantive right.
Would you like to address the harmless error question?
I would love to, Your Honor, thank you. So Well, first, we would argue, of course, that they did fall under the exception. We do feel like these text messages were evidence related, were communications related to an ongoing crime, and that it was a joint ongoing crime. You know, the crime was conspiracy. And it's important to remember that a conspiracy continues until the objective is fulfilled. As the indictment in this case indicated, the conspiracy lasted from a certain point all the way through October, I believe 28 of 2014. These text messages were sent in September of 2014. And so the conspiracy was still happening as the state's theory was at the time of trial. And this court has held that statements related to past events may be admissible under a conspiracy if they are in furtherance of the conspiracy or serve some current purpose, such as to provide cohesiveness, to provide reassurances to a co-conspirator, or to prompt one, not a member of the conspiracy, to respond in a way that furthers the goals of the conspiracy. Now, of course, the state's position was that that's exactly what these text messages did. This was perhaps a textbook example of providing cohesiveness with his co-conspirator, or reassurances to the co-conspirator that everything was going to be okay, or prompting the co-conspirator to act, to battle, to let them watch, we're going to be good, to choose to let us burn or choose to help us beat this, or I got us, watch. So our first primary argument, of course, is that these fell under the exception. Now, if this court were to rule that the exception shouldn't have applied, or that if it did apply, that these text messages didn't fall under the exception, of course, we do have the harmless error argument. It's hard to imagine an error more harmless than one that led to acquittal, which is our main position in this case. She was acquitted of conspiracy, and these text messages were admitted as proof of the conspiracy. She was only convicted of official misconduct, for which she gave statements admitting to accessing reports and the sharing of a confidential briefing. There was also a lot of circumstantial evidence as well, which included, in addition to her statements, which included the numerous phone calls that were made prior to the wiretap going into effect. And then once the wiretap goes into effect, the number of phone calls falls exponentially. I believe 135 phone calls were made between the defendant and other targets in the investigation before the wire. After the wire, 6. 939 calls were made between the defendant and other targets in the defendant's husband and other targets in the operation. And again, only 6 afterward. That evidence clearly went to the benefit received through her official misconduct. In addition, these text messages were sent in September, and we know that the conspiracy was ongoing because the second official misconduct count didn't take place until October when she shared that briefing. And so we know this wasn't the end, or this wasn't an afterthought conversation once she decided to stop conspiring. At least that was the state's position at trial. But these things continued until and through October. And so that was the state's position. That was the state's argument. And to the extent that these text messages had anything to do with official misconduct, it was very, very, very limited.
To follow up, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, please, Justice, go ahead.
I was just gonna ask you, I'm sorry, a very technical factual issue, because I opened up the rules of evidence. And at the end of it, the rule in the rule book, it has Ed note, and it says amended by legislature, L 2015, chapter 138, section 2, effective November 9th, 2015. And my question to you, because I don't have the bill in front of me, is that a representation of what was on the legislative bill, effective November 9th, 2015? That's what the legislature said, not what some comment said.
Thank you. Yes, I have it right here, Your Honor. And in fact, in the end notes, or where they're offering, or at the very end, point three of the chat, it's PL 2015, chapter 138. It says three, this act shall take effect immediately. Okay. And then approved November 9th, 2015.
Okay. So it was
there was no gap between when this legislation was approved and when it became effective. It became effective immediately.
Okay.
Mr. Hine, I've gotten a copy of the book and I wanted to pick up on something Justice Albin pointed out. What has been referred to as a comment, are we talking about what the editors of the Horn Book have added?
That's
not a comment by the court?
Yes, that's my understanding. That's simply the editors. I don't think that's something the court should rely on as they would the legislation, which, as I just indicated, clearly said that this went into effect immediately.
Yeah, but we still don't know when it says effective November 9th, whether or not that meant it was effective in 2014 when the communications occurred. So you still have the same debate. Is it effective for the trial or is it effective for the actual communication? Yes?
I agree. Yes, Your Honor.
In either event, that comment, editor's note, what have you, is not a definitive statement on the issue before the court.
Absolutely not. I would just conclude, in addition to harmless, the state's position is that not only was this harmless, but this was actually an invited error. While it might not be the textbook version of invited error, it's important to remember the procedural history of how this issue came up. This issue came up by the defense's motion months before trial began. And the defense argued, as my adversaries are arguing today, that the ex post facto clause prohibited application or the availability of this rule, this change in rule, at the time of trial. The judge ruled, however, the judge specifically ruled that he was not going to address particular texts. He only ruled to the general availability of the crime fraud exception, finding that it would apply. Now, fast forward months before trial, having been told specifically to object at the time if you felt like these text messages didn't fall within the exception, the defendant allowed them to come in, no objection made. And then when the defendant testified at trial, spent, I don't know exactly how much time, but at least 8 transcribed pages going through these text messages line by line, offering her alternative theory of the case, which of course—
are you suggesting that objecting to the evidence coming in a pretrial motion and not voicing an additional objection alone constitutes invited error?
I am, Your Honor. And it only in unique circumstances like this. Obviously, plain error would normally be the reviewing standard when no objection has been made. But I believe when a defendant brings forth an issue such as this, makes you know all the arguments, even at one point saying that, you know, Your Honor, you're going to need to make a decision, you know, when we get to these text messages, you're going to need to find that these fall under the crime fraud exception. It was on his radar. And so
why aren't you sticking with your harmless error argument?
We're
based on the two different charges that we're talking about here.
Your Honor, we're certainly not backing away from harmless error. I'm just offering this, I think, as an alternative.
Because your invited error argument, you know, just speaking candidly, at least my own view, is potentially problematic when you have situations where you have a pretrial ruling and a lawyer figures that ship has sailed when the time comes for the evidence to come in at trial. You see what I'm saying is that's a broad view of invited error. Invited error. It's generally situations, at least as I understand it, where a lawyer encourages a court to go in a particular direction as opposed to simply accepting a pretrial ruling and not fighting over it in the exigent situation of a trial going on.
I agree wholeheartedly with Your Honor. I guess my point is that this wasn't an aspect of the ship had sailed. the only ship that had sailed at that point was that the ex post facto clause didn't violate the availability of the rule at the time. No ship had ever sailed regarding the text messages themselves. And defendant was specifically told that when those text messages were revealed, and if you had an objection to them falling under the language of the rule, not whether the rule applied, but simply the language of the rule, well, then voice your objection and I'll make...
Did defense counsel in any way encourage this evidence to be admitted?
Well, Your Honor, there's sins of omission and sins of commission. And I believe under the invited error standard, there are instances, and this is one, where not voicing an objection is the same thing as acquiescing or inviting it. He knew he was to object. And
I don't think that's advancing your argument, just speaking for one.
Okay. Well, with that then, Your Honor, I don't have anything to add. Unless the court has any other questions, we'd rest on our brief and ask the court to affirm both courts below.
Thank you, Mr. Hine. Justice Albin, did you? Mr. Cooper Dobb.
Good morning, Your Honors. The questions here regarding the applicability of the crime fraud exception in this case can basically be divided into two major points, ex post facto arguments and arguments regarding statutory construction. And so I'll address those both separately. The ex post facto analysis here should really be very simple. The defendant's claiming that this modification, this addition of the crime fraud exception to the written rules violated the fourth definition of the fourth Calder definition or fourth Carmel definition, or it's the same definition, which that definition, while admittedly a little difficult to parse on first reading, can basically be boiled down to a simple phrase, which is it violates ex post facto if it receives less or different testimony in order to convict the offender. That's the key analysis here. And this provision has been, as far as I'm aware, universally interpreted as applying to changes in the law that would lower either the quantum of evidence, the sufficiency of evidence, or the burden of proof for the state in order to obtain a lawful conviction. So the worry here is if the law as it had stood at the date of the offense, if the defendant could not have been convicted under the laws that stood at the date of the offense, but then the law has changed and now the defendant can be convicted of that based on the exact same evidence presented each time. Now, the situation we have here is completely different. The rule change here does not change the quantum of evidence required for a lawful conviction, does not change the burden of proof. It creates the possibility that additional evidence may come in. And as there's been discussion of, Carmel discussed at length how that sort of change does not implicate ex post facto. And in fact, defendant, nobody in this case has ever cited to a single authority that says that this sort of law change that potentially allows in more evidence should come in under that fourth Calder category. There's no support for that whatsoever.
Okay. So, counsel, you heard the Chief Justice's hypothetical given to your fellow counsel. Assume that these text messages were either the only evidence or the essential evidence for a conviction. And previously, it would not have been admitted, and therefore, there would not have been sufficient proof to find the defendant guilty.
Certainly,
is your argument the same?
I don't see how that would affect the analysis. If in Rose the hearsay evidence had been the only evidence against Rose,
I'm looking at Calder.
I'm sorry.
Different, less or different.
Yes.
Different testimony.
Yes, if it allows conviction on less or different testimony. So the question, respectfully, Your Honor, is not can different testimony come in. The testimony is, I'm sorry, pardon me. The question is, would this does the change enable conviction based on different testimony? So it's not a case specific. We wouldn't look at it case by case and say, well, here maybe it allowed conviction on different testimony and here it didn't. But it's all about the change in the laws. Does it change the evidence necessary to obtain a lawful conviction? So whether it's the only evidence or not makes no difference to the analysis.
There's no fairness component, as you understand it, that would affect the analysis. Is that what we're hearing from you?
The question of fairness. So the core question of fairness addressed by ex post facto is fairness in terms of notice to citizens of what's illegal. What is a crime? So you have to be on notice. If you do this, you can be convicted of a crime. The question here was not, is what they're doing illegal? They knew they were committing a crime. The question is, could they get away with it?
No, it's notice of whether or not your communications are protected. So do you take the position of your counsel that if the legislature had abrogated the marital privilege, your argument would be the same? It comes in. It's a rule of evidence that could be abolished at any particular time. The fact that you relied on it is immaterial. Do you ascribe to that position?
Yes, Your Honor. As defendant, in fact, noted earlier in her argument, the privilege is creation of common law. And so the legislature has the ability, now it's codified, and the legislature has the ability to change statutes. Now, repealing the marital communications privilege is probably a terrible idea, but everything that's a bad idea isn't unconstitutional.
And your position is, to be clear, that if it is repealed, it would apply retroactively, and then the communications would come into evidence.
My position is that it would apply prospectively to all future cases, okay, which is how rules of evidence are traditionally applied. And that's sort of the core of ex post facto too. You can see how the way these definitions that we see in Calder work sort of fits in with then this substantive procedural distinction is that things that are changing what's a crime, what's lawful to do in the past, implicate ex post facto protections, what you can be convicted for, how a conviction, what the state must prove in order to obtain a conviction, is substantive and violates ex post facto, and if it pertains to what evidence can come in, that is not. The defendant also discussed here, the defendant said that that Carmel actually reiterated a distinction for ex post facto purposes between substantive and procedural laws. But in fact, Carmel did the exact opposite. I just want to point out that Carmel on page 539, in fact, said, the better understanding of Collins' discussion is that it eliminated a doctrinal hitch that had developed in our cases, which purported to define the scope of the clause along an axis distinguishing between laws involving substantial protections and those that are merely procedural. It goes on that says, the prohibition which may not be evaded is the Calder categories. Whether it's substantive or procedural does not matter for ex post facto analysis. Where that may come into play, though, is when we get to the statutory construction section, because clearly, defendant, I think everyone's on the same page that substantive laws are applied prospectively in terms of the acts they govern, and that procedural rule changes apply prospectively in future cases, regardless of when the acts below occurred. We can see from many ways that this is intended really to be a procedural law. And one thing we can look at with that is that this court and the legislature and the governor adopted this rule change through the Evidence Act, which not just, of course, controls evidentiary rules and indicates its procedural purpose, but also the terms of the Evidence Act, in fact, say that evidence rules passed through the Evidence Act cannot change substantive rights. So, for this court and the legislature, the governor, to have all said we're adopting this through the Evidence Act is in fact a very clear indicator that it does not impact substantive rights. And of course, were this court to hold that privileges are substantive rights.
Well, how about the law against incrimination? That is a common law right in New Jersey, has not been adopted in our state constitution. Are you telling me that that is not a substantive right?
It has been adopted by our state.
Forget about the United States Constitution. It is in our rules of evidence. It is not in our Constitution. Are you saying that the law against incrimination is not a substantive right?
Well, it's a constitutional right. So the question, I think, would come down to there may be a distinction, even if the legislature abolished the evidentiary rule ensconcing the rule against self-incrimination, it would still be unconstitutional to compel self-incrimination.
Well, forget about the federal constitution. Assume that the federal constitution didn't apply, okay, under the incorporation doctrine. In our state, okay, since the founding of our state and the republic, the law against self-incrimination has been a common law right, never incorporated into our Constitution. Are you saying that that would not be a substantive right?
I'm not. I mean, maybe the problem would be then that the court and the legislature would not be able to pass a law revoking the law against the rule against self-incrimination, because that would be a substantive right. So in fact, if the court were and the legislature were making changes to substantive rights through the Evidence Act, then those changes would be void.
I want to come back to the right that we're talking about here.
Certainly.
The marital privilege encompasses a number of things. Was there a substantive right to speak with one's spouse in a way that furthers criminal activity?
No, and in fact, that's exactly what Terry found, was that there was no right to do that. I mean, as I believe I pointed out in my brief, often in some cases, if they're planning a first or second degree crime or a drug distribution crime, that conversation itself forms the crime of conspiracy. So there's not just not a right to have it, it's illegal to have it. So Terry very clearly said, this is not part of the right.
If that's the case, was it necessary to amend why did we have to amend the rule?
Well, it was a curative amendment to make it clear to courts below. Now, I'm not aware of any court ever having applied the rule
Is it your argument we didn't have to amend the rule? We just did it for what? For the fun of it?
Well, I would anticipate that the rules are amended all the time in order to make them clearer to the lawyers and judges who use them. So this is a good way of making it clear and saying, we recognize that this marital communications privilege as written.
We didn't apply, I may be mistaken about this, but in Terry, I don't think we applied the crime for an exception in that case. We left it to the legislature to amend, correct? Or am I mistaken about that?
You did send it to the legislature amendment the same way you did following Byrd.
So we didn't on our own say this is a natural exception to the marital privilege.
Well, you did write that it was certainly the gist of it was that it was not intended to be within the marital privilege. It was not ever intended to be part of that privilege.
Doesn't the court in Terry specifically say if that? The as written, this kind of evidence does not come in as written at the time before the amendment, specifically says that.
I believe it said, what's the language? There was specific language about the way it was written. And now I cannot find it. I apologize, Your Honors. I know it did say something along those lines. I think the gist of that was that, you know, it's clear that as it was laid out, it's clear that it could be interpreted as barring that. And that this
more definitive than that. I think the court made a definitive statement that it's written. That kind of evidence would not be permitted hence the need for the amendment.
Well, that may be, Your Honor. I'm not sure, but the point I think of Terry was that this was not ever intended to be part of the privilege, and that it's not a right that the court or the society feels is worth protecting. Looking back at the idea of interpreting privileges as being substantive.
Just to follow up, I mean, to follow the argument by it to its logical conclusion, the substantive right here would have to be, because the marital privilege generally is not subject to the amendment, the substantive right would have to be if the communication were within the crime fraud exception as existed in, as exceptions to other rules of evidence, there was a substantive right to engage in that communication without a concern about disclosure, right? That would have to be the substantive right, not the general marital privilege, because this amendment never didn't abrogate the general marital privilege.
That's right, Your Honor.
I don't want to beat a dead horse here and this going off Judge Fuente, but if that were the case, then we would have we would not have permitted the defendants in Terry to hide behind the spousal privilege. They would have been stripped of it then.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, it was Terry was remanded and there was and it was left unclear whether it was left up to the trial court whether to apply the crime fraud exception upon remand or not. So I'm not sure that the court can be characterized as the court allowing the defendants to hide behind it more than sort of delaying the discussion for another day. Looking back at the sort of way the privilege works in terms of the statutory construction, it's very clear that the privilege and the crime fraud exception are structured in terms of what happens at proceedings. So there's been a lot of discussion about, well, a spouse makes a statement and is privileged and then is taken away. Well, that simply doesn't work that way. You can't make a statement and say, my statement's privileged, because there are all sorts of different exceptions. So you really cannot measure whether a statement is privileged until you're trying to assert that privilege in some sort of proceeding down the road. Because if there's a subsequent action between the spouses, then no communication between them was privileged. If there's a subsequent action regarding, I think it's spousal or child abuse, then statements are not privileged. There's no marital communications privilege that's applicable in that case. So it's simply not true to say they knew the statement was privileged and it could never be disclosed, because it can be disclosed based on the circumstances. And so what the rule did is say, here's an additional circumstance in which disclosure is permissible. But there are already several other circumstances where disclosure is permissible there too. So again, both the privilege and the exception itself are really focused on the procedure and not on the statements itself. It certainly could have been written in a different way had it intended to focus on the statements, but it was not. And just one other thing I'd point out, if there's a ruling that this amendment, another indication that the legislature intended this amendment to function prospectively, and I mean prospectively in future cases, but regardless of when statements were made, is the amendment in 2015 made two changes. It added the crime fraud exception, and it also expanded the privilege to partners in civil unions. Now, civil unions were created by the legislature in 2007, and I believe same-sex marriage was legalized in 2013. So 2 years before the civil union language was added to the privilege. Now, certainly there are still civil unions still exist, but presumably fewer than you would have had same-sex marriage not been legalized. So it'd be odd indeed for the legislature to add civil unions to this privilege and say, well, we only mean that in statements after we've added civil unions. All the statements made by civil union partners between 2007 and 2015 can still come in willy-nilly because they weren't privileged. So there are many ways in which it's clear that the legislature understood this to be a procedural change in which it should be interpreted as a procedural change, not the least of which is because interpreting it as a substantive change causes many other potential problems. I think,
Council, if to get back to my original question, if you find that Terry, where you were looking for, and Terry is on page 229.
Thank you, Your Honor. Earlier than I thought.
It says, in its present form, the privilege protects communication between spouses about criminal activities that are jointly planning or committing, and that the aspect of the privilege does not serve its purpose and undermines the public interest in attaining justice. That's why it needed to be amended.
That's right, Your Honor. So I think the kind of what they're saying there is, in its present form, it could apply this way, but that's not the way it's supposed to apply.
But we affirm the appellate division, which reversed the convictions based upon the admission of the spousal privilege. Am I mistaken about that? And Terry.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay.
And there was no remand in the case.
Your Honor. I'm sorry. I must have been.
It's all right.
I apologize, Your Honors. I must have been completing with another case.
What Terry did was consider the argument that the state was advancing that there should not be protection for the sort of communications that were later exempted from it. And made a recommendation, but it wasn't a ruling. I believe Judge Fuentes correctly referred you to the holding.
You're right, Your Honors. I apologize. I would note that Terry itself actually specifically did refer to this change as being comparable to the changes in Byrd and NDR, which of course were both applied retroactively. So in trying to draw a distinction between privileges and other rules, you know, this court in Terry, you know, said that it's comparable, and that's on page 243 of Terry.
We said it was comparable for reasons that it had to go through the Evidence Act of 1960. We didn't amend the rule ourselves. That's why we were referring to Byrd, correct? Right.
Yes.
I'm not sure that Terry answers the question and that we need to spend more time on it. Terry said this would be a fundamental change. Therefore, as in Byrd, we're sending it to the legislature. It doesn't address whether a rule the legislature had yet to adopt would be retroactive or purely prospective. Would you agree?
Yes, Your Honor. We wouldn't be here otherwise. It does say, yes, it does. It said it was a fundamental change to the rules of evidence, and it did often couch it in those terms. This is a change to the evidentiary rules.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to your presentation?
No, Your Honor. With all that, the Attorney General was simply asked for the case to be affirmed.
Ms. Jarrett, rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to make 4 points on rebuttal. The first is that, as you just noted, Terry did say this would be a fundamental change to the privilege. I know there's a lot of reliance on the fact that this court has said that it was never intended for this kinds of communication to be part of the privilege. However, the plain language of the rule did include all of this, of these types of communications as under the privilege, and interpreting a privilege that did not have this exception to have somehow included this exception that, to mean, you know, that it wasn't part of the substantive protections of that law would really chill speech and would have a detrimental impact on all of the privileges. A person would not be able to just look and rely, including lawyers, at the plain language of the rules and believe that conversations that they are having with their clients, their spouses, their doctors would remain confidential because they would be afraid that some future case years from now might interpret the privilege in another way to include some exception that is not there at all. I think this would have a huge detrimental impact, not only to the fundamental rights that are being protected, but also to speech, which I think the ACLU has talked about in their brief. The next point I would like to make is I would like to respond to the citation to all the out-of-state cases. Those cases dealt primarily with the spousal testimonial privilege, which the purpose of that privilege is to allow a spouse to decline to testify against their other spouse. And the behavior that they're concerned with is making sure that a spouse is not forced to testify against their spouse, which would either one, destroy the relationship, or two, force that spouse to commit perjury, essentially, on the stand. So the protected behavior occurs at the time of trial. And so it makes sense for the rule to there is no real retroactive application there, because the rule being applied at the time of trial concerns that behavior at the time of trial. Those cases are distinguishable from the marital communications privilege, which concerns the out-of-court behavior that could have taken place a year prior, potentially, the communications between the spouses. The third point I'd like to make is that these text messages did not merely relate to the conspiracy charge that Ms. Bailey was acquitted of. They were relied on by the state as evidence of her intent and her alleged purpose to secure a benefit in the misconduct statutes. And that was underscored by the prosecutor during summation. Fourth, I would like to point out that the less or different testimony language of the Calder's fourth category, I mean, this is clearly allowing different testimony. And here, as I just noted, the state really relied on these text messages to establish one of the elements of the offense. And there was a Reyes motion in this case concerning these two charges in particular, because the state had very little evidence besides these text messages concerning her purpose and intent. And the court said it's gonna go to the jury. And so I think this does relate to a change in allowing evidence to suffice as a quantum of evidence to establish an element of the offense as well. Unless your honors have any other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Jarrett. Thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under